Welcome. You are listening to The Creative Spark. My name is G. Brian Benson, and I'm an award-winning author, project coach, actor, TEDx speaker, creative, and four-time Ironman triathlete. I love to creatively inspire and be inspired. And with each episode, I will be talking of authors, athletes, entrepreneurs, artists, and actors sharing their journey of success and learning how to find the joy and peace of mind that comes with stepping into one's own skin and going beyond anything they might previously have thought possible. I hope that their stories and strategies provide insight, tools, and empowerment to step up your creative game and help you live your best life. So without further ado, let's get going.
My guest today is Justin Foster. He's a brand strategist, poet, and professional agitator who helps conscious entrepreneurs and leaders turn their callings into unforgettable brands. He's the co-founder of Massive Change, a strategic advisory firm that blends the art of messaging with the science of movements to equip mission-centric organizations to lead systemic change and fight back against authoritarianism. Justin is also the creator of Ethos, a philosophy of conscious branding that rejects manipulation and builds brands with moral clarity, scalable genius, and lasting impact. His path runs from the ranch roots in Eastern Oregon to building several successful brand agencies to a series of awakenings that made him dangerous to obsolete institutions to now living in Mexico City. Welcome, Justin. There's a lot to unwrap there.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, you're welcome. How are you doing today?
Thanks for I'm pretty good. Thanks for having me on. That was quite the intro.
Well, it's you. I mean, it's so interesting how that works. Like sometimes I'll hear maybe somebody kind of, relate my best of or my highlight reel or whatever, my bio. And it's like, wait, who is that? That's not me. You know, right? It's but we got to own it.
Yep.
Got to own it. So let's just dive in. There's a lot to talk about. I believe, and I'm sure that you'll agree with me, that authenticity is more important than ever. When did you realize that one of your callings was to help entrepreneurs show up as their authentic selves?
Well, I think it was more of an emerging thing. I think many of us that grew up in, unstable environments, adopt kind of a hologram of how we think we need to be in the world. And for many people, tragically, that's all they think they are. They don't have any sort of inciting incident that says, oh, wait, that's not even who I am. So one of my early sort of mantras as I began my even before I was self-employed, was to teach what I learn. And one of the things that I learned is that we are not who we think we are. There's essentially, if you look at it from almost a Jungian perspective, an I and a me. And most people never meet the I. They only know the me. And the me is that sort of projection onto the world. Well, then when you have people that are in a, say, branding situation, they're branding themselves, or they're a leader, which is a leader, is leadership is a brand as well, is then if you don't know who you are, you will inevitably project something onto the world that is not authentic. It may be believable, but it's not you. So therefore it can't be authentic. And so that work for me started, you know, really where I was teaching it to others, that probably started about 15 years ago. And continues today, and you know, always learning, always evolving, but helping people find their true self and express it to the world is what I do. That's what I'm here to do.
Yeah, I love that. Where do you see your clients struggle the most before they connect with you?
Well, especially men tend to be very tactical. And the man brain, they don't worry about it until it stops working, you know, literally or metaphorically. And so, It's the moving the focus away from the tactical aspect of it to it's not your image that's the issue, or it's not the, that you need to better be, communication style, or, the all of the sort of surfacey stuff. For women clients, it's more of a reaffirmation of their power and value. And there's with some women clients, there's been sort of a subconscious adoption of patriarchal perspectives, even if they're not aware of it. And in both cases, the goal is to deconstruct who you think you are, and then go express who you find out who you really are, and then go share it with the world with the absolute belief that who you really are it adds something of value to the world.
Yeah. I know for myself that the whole self-acceptance and self-love issue has been kind of a lifelong growth process for me. And I would imagine that's the case for some of the people that you work with. And so you probably have to unravel and bring self-awareness to that particular point as well. I mean, that's all probably part of it, correct?
And that's why it's not a coincidence that most of my clients have done inner work. They go to therapy, they've deconstructed from obsolete beliefs. Many of my clients are not, they come from what we consider traditionally marginalized groups, where you have to kind of find your identity, because the system kind of swallows you if you don't. I would also say that everybody that I've worked with over the years, especially in the last 15 years, they already kind of knew that something was off. And instead of coming to me to try to fix what was off, they come to me and I help them understand it's just a message. It's just your soul trying to tell you something. It doesn't mean something's wrong. It just means you got to do something differently. And the starting point for that is in a sense of intrinsic worth. The work I do, whether it's coaching person or coaching them on their brand, or it's all sort of the same thing to me, is it all begins inside, with the intrinsic set of identity and beliefs and values and virtues and talents and things like that before we ever get to the extrinsic, which is sort of how you present to the world. I don't ever start there, because if you don't know who you are, or you don't believe, if you don't have a deep connection to some sense of self-worth, what will happen is, especially in branding, is that you will try to use branding to solve an identity crisis, and that's a terrible idea. So.
Yeah, that reminds me, like earlier on when I was starting my kind of creative journey and starting to put stuff out there, and I'm very proud of everything I did, but I realized looking back that I was using it as a validation tool. And so I would imagine that some people, before they become, come to you or become more self-aware in the self-acceptance process, they probably use branding as a little bit of a validation tool as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And it kind of goes to the common thing about imposter syndrome. And I point this out to people, and hopefully, I don't say this in a mean way, but the reason you have imposter syndrome is you're being an imposter. It's your soul saying, oh, that's not you. Well, you don't try to fix imposter syndrome. You try to fix why you are just, you think you have to be an imposter. And that's a lot of the work that I do is, because if you have imposter syndrome, everything is often, especially a lot of my clients are neurodivergent too, is like imposter syndrome is associated with shame, and then you got to go out and like go to networking events, or you're going to give a talk, or shoot, you're going to try to change the copy on your website, and you don't actually believe in what you don't believe in yourself enough. That is definitely going to come out in the way that you present, and how that most often comes out is you start to sound like everybody else.
Yes. And I think a lot of people who do what you do try to, or in the marketing realm, try to kind of see what's popular, see what's happening, and just kind of maybe funnel their client into to what everybody else is doing, correct?
Yes.
And there's just it, and then it
Yes.
just becomes part of the noise.
Yeah, and I would, I would be, for me, this is my perspective on it. I would be even more condemning, if you will, of the people in my industry's willingness to either A, create monetized codependency, or B, to manipulate someone's fear and uncertainties and doubts into a type of monetized codependency. And it would, because it's fairly easy to do that. It's a fairly easy business model to
But you mean target
say,
the
hey,
people's
we're good.
pain points?
Yes. Yes. But even like their client, go to a client and say, we're going to, they wouldn't, they, no one rarely, except very few people in the marketing world will come to someone and go, oh, I think what the problem is that you don't really know who you are. What they would say is, oh, we're going to take that insecurity or that worry, and we're going to extract as much money as we can from the client in order to, because it's a great motivator to continue to spend money. And in many ways, that is the agency model, especially for agencies that sell to small business owners. And I find it, I find it distasteful, to say the least.
Sure, I know that I've wasted money in the past on maybe hiring someone in a lot of different ways, whether it's for marketing or what have you. And that's kind of basically what happened, and it never worked because it never resonated with me and I wasn't able to own it.
That's right. Yes. And it's that's why one of the other from the inner work that I do with a client, then that the part that is sort of naturally evolves to them finding your voice is like, I don't use auto tune. I'm not an auto tuner, I am that's
Good.
I'm much more like Rick Rubin, which is, I'm not going to tell you what to sing or how to sing, but I'm going to tell you if I don't believe you when you sing,
Love that. Yeah. I've heard you use the term spiritual enterprise. I have a feeling it's already kind of a little bit of what we talked about, but maybe delve more into that.
Yeah. So to me, a spiritual enterprise is when your calling and your brand and your business are all the same thing. And I'm not saying that everybody should do it that way. Like if somebody owns a bunch of storage units, I'm not saying that's their calling. And I'm not saying that they're not doing good things in the world with their money or whatever. But if you feel like your calling and your business model and your brand are all the same thing, which is really what a creative is, then it means that it doesn't follow the same rules as a traditional enterprise. For example, the goal is to be original, not to sound like everybody else. You don't worry about target audiences. You don't worry about niching. You don't worry about certain things like that. The other thing that's very different with a spiritual enterprise is timing. Is the timing doesn't belong to you. You still have to have effort, and yes, you still got to make money, but it's like David Hawkins's books of The Force, and the some of the things he talks about related to consciousness, is you can't force your way into the world with your brand or your business, if it's a spiritual enterprise, because the timing doesn't really belong to you. And a third one that's very different is in a spiritual enterprise, your audience is not who you're looking for. Your audience is who's looking for you. So your responsibility is to be findable and memorable and repeatable. That's your responsibility. It's to be findable, but it's not to like select a target audience and try to sell stuff to them that you think that they need or whatever. So there's many other examples of that, but to me, that's what a spiritual enterprise is.
I love this, and it's definitely something that I know I have probably in my heart. I know that this is the way I need to do it, but yet I have been guilty of trying to niche and make things fit, and it never took off because I just, like I said earlier, my heart was not behind it. And I really, those are, yeah, I really love that.
Well, you said something key there, Brian, about the heart. And part of knowing who you really are is knowing your own heart. And much of the systems that we operate in, especially in the business world, kind of discourage heart. They discourage empathy. They discourage compassion. They discourage that as, the data. It's just data. Give me the data. And my point is, intuition is data. And so, but if you got to know your heart, and the beautiful thing about the heart is the heart always knows what to say. And if you speak from the heart, you have nothing to fear because the heart really can't be rejected. Only the ego can. So you say what you need to say with your messaging or your offering. And I'm not saying that you feel all confident all of the time, but if you're coming from your heart, at least you're not using, guile or manipulation, or your motivation is different when you're coming from the heart.
And I think it's like I touched on at the beginning, authenticity is more important than ever. And I think this what you're sharing right now is so important, because I think people just, in even though they might not be able to speak it in words, but more and more people are beginning to wake up within, and they're wanting authenticity and vulnerability and real. And we're just tired of being fed inauthentic material in all kinds of different ways. I really believe that. And yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. How do you utilize your own creative gifts in what you do when you help others and with your different businesses?
Well, I don't, that's a really good question, because
This is the creative spark after all.
yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, I guess some of it is creativity is curiosity and mixed with a little bit of courage, and turned into something. You got to pick up the brush and paint the line, and you got to be in execution mode. It's not a theory. Creativity isn't. It's not a feeling. There's evidence of it, and but it's, a lot of it starts with curiosity. And I think so there's another element to me that if I get too up in my head with helping or working with a client, coaching a client, I am going to have like a more of an ego stake in what they decide to do. And that never goes well. Because I'm making it sort of subtly about me, and like, why didn't you follow my advice? And don't you think I'm brilliant? And as opposed to thinking like in a collaborative way or as a co-creator of their brand that they're putting out into the world. And there's a kind of humility, I guess, there. It's like somebody asked George Jones, the legendary country singer, how'd you write all those songs? And he says, I didn't. I just held the pen, And so there's an element of that. And Stephen Pressfield talks about this, and Rick Rubin and Julia Cameron and other brilliant people in the creative space. And so I think as I think further about your question is, I'll put it this way. Nobody trusts a chubby personal trainer. like you got a or a dentist with bad teeth, is like if I'm going to teach and talk about creativity and source and power and sacral energy and all of the things that kind of are a part of the creativity as a spiritual thing in particular, I must embody that. So that's why I don't worry about, like, I write poems, I write political commentary, I write philosophical stuff. I'm all over the place. Like, all I need to know is that it came from my soul and I felt like sharing it. And so I need to embody what I am teaching or suggesting to my clients. I'm not saying do it like me, like you have to do the same exact thing, but if I'm not practicing it, how can I teach it?
I love that and I agree. Share about your poetry a little bit. If you'd like.
Well, it's interesting. I've written poetry really my whole life. I remember writing it as a kid, poetry and songs and things, and I never shared it. I never shared my poetry with other than like maybe like my very, very inner circle. But publicly, I never shared my poetry until January of 2020, which is that was a hell of a year. And it's what we didn't know. I mean, the most, yeah, the what we didn't know in 20, January 2020. But I'm a big fan of there's a global group of creatives called Creative Mornings, and there's a chapter in, I don't know, like, I don't know how many cities now, 80 cities around the world.
Oh, never heard of that.
And so I lived in Austin at the time, and I'd gone to a number of Creative Mornings, and the organizers asked me if I wanted to be the kickoff of the year. And so what I decided to do was read a poem that I wrote publicly and then talk about the unlikely journey of being even on that stage, t reading poetry and talking about poetry. And so that's the first thing that comes to mind. The rest of it is like, I don't have a particular topic when I write poetry. It's just sometimes it feels like this should be a poem, and so I write it as a poem. And I think it's especially true related to like the heaviest, or I shouldn't say heaviest, the biggest emotions. I tend to write poetry when it's about love or desire or gratitude, but also when it's about grief or anger or fear. It seems like that's just the best way for me to kind of get it out of me, so I can, so it makes a little bit more sense. And I don't have any particular structure either. Like, I mean, sometimes it rhymes, sometimes it doesn't. And what I learned is from Mary Oliver in particular is it doesn't have to rhyme. It just has to resonate.
It's got to make you feel. I love that. And in some ways, it's probably very healing, maybe too. I know for me, I think our styles sound kind of similar. There is no real rhyme or reason. A lot of times I do rhyme, but yet other times it's not. And sometimes it's about just the life and self-growth process, you know what I mean? And in my own experiences and some of the tough stuff I've gone through and what have you. But yeah, I think it can be very cathartic. And I think acting was that way for me too. That was kind of before I really began to really just maybe let stuff out consciously. And so I was holding a lot of stuff in. So whenever I got an acting gig that maybe dealt with some anger or some sadness, it's just like I could just turn it on in a half a second because it's like, oh, I can, I'm given permission to do this. And I wasn't doing giving myself permission prior to that. But I'm, yeah. So I digress. But
No, it's okay.
yeah, how do you take care of your own creative practice? How do you nurture it? How do you refill your cup? How do you
Well, I try not to use poetry or creativity, writing, any form of it, as like a coping mechanism. Like I'm not saying that's just me. Like I don't I want poetry or create or writing to be an additive, not a supplement to my life. And I want it to be an expression of awareness or consciousness. This has changed over the years is that I've learned that the best way to nurture creativity is to practice self-love. And that means, spiritual, physical, emotional health across the board. And that if I'm poetry in many ways is being a conduit. It not really a creator, but conduit, and is if I'm not tuned in to my soul, creativity kind of honestly just dries up. It's just like it goes away, and that's why to me, I is this in Taoism and the chakras and everything. The second chakra is sexual energy and creative energy come from the same place in that kind of framework. And so you get sort of the creativity version of low libido if you don't take care of yourself, and so I kind of use it as like also like a reverse indicator. Like if I don't feel like creating over not like every day, but like if it's been like a dry spell, I'd be like, oh, I've been up in my head, or I've been way too task oriented. Or I've been way too stressed, or I've been in reactive mode and coping mode, and that's not the best place for me to create from. I need to be centered and present and aware, and then it kind of flows through me, generally speaking. I also think, Brian, that for me, nurturing creativity goes back to what I said about curiosity, and that there's kind of a game. Like I love the, especially songwriting, poetry just sort of comes out of me, but songwriting, there's a little bit more structure to it, and there's a challenge to it. It's way more challenging to do songwriting. I don't do melodies. I have a songwriting partner that for that, but the lyrics, it's like a riddle. A lot of it's just paying attention. Like I have a song called Colder Than the Lubbock Wind. I write country music, and this comes from getting gas in Lubbock, Texas in like February, and it's cold as balls in Lubbock, Texas. People don't realize, especially that time of the year. And I was like, nothing's colder than the Lubbock wind. And I finished pumping gas and I sat in the car. And I wrote a song like about that, about and the line, the key line is nothing is colder, nothing, the only thing colder than her is the Lubbock wind. And and I framed it around like the boom or bust culture of Lubbock, Texas, and everything. And to me, though, that's way different than writing poetry. In this case, the creative nurturing is almost just paying attention to something going, oh, that's a good lyric. There's something there. And that's fun. That's fun because it's way more challenging than writing poetry for me.
I love that and can totally relate. I think that that's the same for me with children's stories because most of them do rhyme and it almost becomes like a mental jigsaw puzzle. And it's a combination of intuitively feeling it out and putting it together, but yet also maybe playing with the thesaurus a little bit. And a little left and right brain action going on for me.
Yes, exactly. There is definitely more left brain, like structural It feels a little bit more like engineering to write a song.
That's fascinating. I love that. I love that. What are some obstacles you've endured or some areas that you have struggled with as you ventured through your own, self-growth journey and process?
Well, I mean, it's, I'll put it this way. For a long time, I rejected the idea of privilege until I understood it as systemic and not circumstantial, because I felt like so much of my life was a struggle and a challenge. Like I was born in, like I was born in 1970, a time of like great divisiveness, and the Beatles had broken up and Nixon was president and the Vietnam War was still like raging and the Cold War and the Summer of Love and what had been 2 summers prior, and it's like I was sort of born into the storm. And that was true in my home life too, growing up in a high control fundamentalist Christian cult, essentially. Abusive home, very abusive home, and then within all that, having being an empath and near and not knowing for years that I had, ADHD, and then many of other things. Everything kind of felt like a challenge. And I'm not saying that it's somehow it's not a challenge anymore, but now it's more like a chosen challenges, and so what I learned though is I don't believe in like toxic positivity, but I did learn, and I have this tattooed on my right arm, the mission is in the suffering. And that I don't necessarily, I think it's a little bit too like Hallmark card or cross stitching on a pillow that to say everything happens for a reason. I think that's kind of lazy spirituality, but I do believe that even the darkest things have material in them that you can create from. And that struggle and tragedy is a creative covered, a creative inventory that feeling safe and protected and privileged all the time doesn't produce. It doesn't produce that. And I think some of the challenges that are kind of ongoing and evolving, but ongoing, is my relationship with my mind. It sucks to be really smart but also really, really insecure at the same time. It sucks to have rejection sensitivity, dysphoria, but also have a deep sense of like I've got shit to say, and so this dichotomy, I've learned to embrace the dichotomy, and that within that is it is the kind of the refinery that keeps me from getting complacent, and it keeps me from getting arrogant, because every time in life I've been arrogant, it always comes back and gets me. It always. But it also, every time I've been full of despair, I've been, it doesn't work either. So it's just really learning to dance with the dichotomies and paradoxes and finding proof of life in the tension between what is and what you hope for.
Thanks for your honesty.
Yeah.
Yeah, I resonate with a lot of what you have to say there.
Yeah. And recently moving to Mexico City, it's been an enormous challenge. Now I chose it, or we chose it, my partner and I, and we chose this, and I don't regret it, but it's way more hard. It's way more difficult than I thought it would be in some areas, mostly systemic, like related to like systems. And but it was in those kind of challenges that I learned to double down too. Like, you don't You really can't accomplish anything in a challenge just sort of sitting and waiting for something to happen. It's like if it's important, there's action involved. And most problems that your most challenges are, they become problems when you don't do anything. They sort of, because the ego is sort of designed that way. You're sort of designed to mire in your own misery. And that's why too, Brian, like I think it goes back to one of your prior questions. Like it is absolutely essential, no matter where you're at in life, to be internally a resource, to be responsible for your own resources related to your spiritual, mental, and physical health. Because nobody's going to do that for you. Even if they have good intentions, they really can't do it for you. You have to choose. It's a kind of autonomy to choose your to choose to be internally resourced. And internally resourced includes, definitely includes asking for help. But it does not include waiting for someone to come along and rescue you.
Man, that's good stuff.
You.
I've heard you referred to as an activated white dude. What does that mean?
Well, I put in one of my bios like a professional agitator, and so this is part of that. That I activated white dude is kind of a it's an acknowledgement of like a couple of things. One is, I think it's essential for leaders to have social consciousness, not just emotional intelligence, but social consciousness. Social consciousness is essentially applying systems thinking to power dynamics. And that people that don't look like you have a different experience than you. And so social consciousness is an awareness of that dynamic. And I'll tell you a very brief story about when I first realized this was Virginia. When I met Virginia, my now wife and partner, she's from Nicaragua. She was an immigrant in the United States. She's a U.S. citizen now, but she was a green card immigrant in the United States when we met. And on our first trip out of town, like flying, I had TSA pre and she didn't, and I just said, not even thinking about it, oh, I'm just going to go through TSA pre. I'll see you on the other side. I'll just wait for you. And she didn't say anything. And then she got through that, and I could tell she was upset. And so I said, why? And it was like this epiphany moment. And she said, I'm with I'm you're a citizen. You go through there and you don't even think about it. She goes, I'm an immigrant. Every single time I come into contact with the government, I fear for my own safety and own security. This is pre the current era that we're in too. And so that was an example of awareness. And so sometimes you see, especially white dudes with power or privilege or whatever, they're like, oh, they're allies. They use that. I'm an ally. I think that's kind of, it's like, it's such a con it's a convenient way to not get involved. So an activated white dude is like, no, I'm going to take what I've got and I'm going to contribute it to the advancement of equality or diversity or justice or things like that. I'm going to contribute. I'm not just going to stand on the sidelines and clap and feel bad when things don't work out for you. It's the literal, almost like skin in the game in this case. And so I say activated because activation is like you're going to take action. And so for me, with that, I'm not saying everyone should do that. It's my choice. But for me, activation is challenging insulated thinking, especially of other white dudes. I get all the time, why do you talk about politics or race or gender on LinkedIn? Well, because that's real life, man. It's like people say, I don't see race. You know who never says that? A person of color. And it's like there's a reality that they're insulated from, and I'm not trying to change someone's mind per se, but I am specifically, strategically, intentionally trying to challenge their paradigm. Because it takes people within the system to be activated to change the system. I think of the most unlikely people to sign the Civil Rights Bill, Lyndon Baines Johnson, President Johnson. He was activated, or he was an activated white dude in that case. Or Branch Rickey, the owner and general manager of the Dodgers, who signed Jackie Robinson. I mean, you could go on down the line. You could look at the NFL doing a complete 180 related to social justice issues after, George Floyd was murdered. Those are the type of things. That's to me what it means is like somebody that's actively involved in using their influence and their power, their platform to contribute to systemic change.
Yeah, that it takes bravery.
Well, it takes a lot less bravery than being an immigrant or being a queer person or, a woman in business, even, like I mean, thank you, but not really. It might take some, it takes some gall, I suppose, and some conviction. But to me, that's me being authentic. And people don't realize this because I am very provocative on social media related to my views about things, especially in the business world. Is I doing all that? I'm doing all that with social anxiety and rejection sensitivity. So for me, it's doubling down. Is I refuse to let that make me afraid to say something. I just refuse to do it because I can't, because I compromise myself. And then I'm like, it bothers me, like in the midst of all the craziness in the world, when you see somebody on LinkedIn and given like the five leadership hacks for, or ways to 10x your, like, it just seems so like tone deaf to the realities of like everybody, of what real life is.
Yeah, I think, and I would put myself in this category a little bit. Some people are it's scary to really share beliefs these days in some ways, you know what I mean? Especially when one struggles with I forgot the exact term that you used, but just
Social anxiety, rejection,
the rejection portion. Yes, of course, and so, I applaud you. And everybody's got their parts to play,
Yeah, they do, right. And I say this too a lot, like if you're a situation where you work for a big company and you're the you're trying to make ends meet, and you've chosen that you're gonna kind of keep your views to yourself because you really need that job. I don't judge anybody for that. I do judge you if you have a bunch of money and you have a bunch of, you have a platform, and you refuse to say something. It goes back to the difference between like Michael Jordan and LeBron James. LeBron was like, well, Republicans buy shoes too. And then LeBron's just coming out and saying exactly what he believes. Is if you got a platform, you have a responsibility. But if you're like a, if you're a rank and file person, you're trying to just make ends meet or whatever, or I don't judge you for that. I judge the complicity of silence from people with power. Because that for authoritarianism to exist, it requires people with power to be quiet. Because if people with power weren't quiet, if they were to say something, then authoritarianism would be, it exists based off of silence from people with power.
We're kind of getting toward the end. I'd like to ask this question to everybody. What's something that you wish you could tell your 20-year-old self?
Man.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Well, I would say this is you are more powerful than you can imagine. you know, 20-year-old Justin was so damaged and so brave to keep showing up and having dreams and hopes. I got married when I was 18 the first time. And, you know, I was like trying to carve out something in the world, but I was so broken inside that I'd never, it was, it felt like it was all just at any moment going to be exposed as like, or taken away. And I would get, if I can, I would say a second thing is that it's okay. And not just okay. I encourage you to be angry about what happened to you. It's like, if you were, if you grew up in a high control religion and you, in an abusive home, you should be angry. And that's healthy. Anger is healthy in this case. And because I was afraid of the anger, I avoided dealing with the root cause of it for many, many years until I think I went to therapy the first time when I was 41. And that's only because I had a huge mental breakdown. I thought I could just get past it, move on, you know, rub some dirt on it. Yeah. And it wasn't until I finally allowed myself to be angry that I didn't realize how much power I actually had.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. What are you really most excited about in life right now? You know, and is there something that you've got going on that you'd like to share with our listeners before we wrap this up?
Well, I love my life with Virginia and my stepson Andre and my family, my sons and their partners and my grandkids, like family. They all live in Portland, and family, I neglected family over the years as an entrepreneur, you know, kind of unintentionally. So I'm really most excited about my family. Like, I'll give you an example, Brian. It's like my younger son, Caden, is a painter, like an artist, and he just shipped his largest commission ever. And that was in the family chat. Like, he should say, I feel like I said, he says, he showed it being loaded on the truck. And he said, I feel like I'm sending my kid off to college. And then a little further down on the same day was orientation for my grandson's first day of preschool. And, you know, those kind of like being able to feel the joy and kind of the bittersweetness of those moments. I used to be very numb about all that. And now, you know, I had a good cry on both of those things. So I'm excited to have like real feelings and feel them. And the same thing with my life with Virginia too, is like, I told her this yesterday that I feel perpetually engaged in our life because I don't want to miss a thing with her. Like any moment, never want to take it for granted. On the business front, I'm really excited about some of the stuff that you read in the bio about Ethos, which is this branding model that I use. And we got some really cool projects. We're working on one for a new music platform, music and promotional platform for women musicians over 40.
Oh, wow.
Which is a client of ours, which is exciting. And then I have this new cohort that I'm rolling out. It's a brand coaching cohort for solo professionals called F the Formula. And it's basically taking 20 plus years of all of my brand and marketing heresy and putting it into 5 principles that teach you how to brand yourself without watering yourself down and fitting yourself into somebody else's algorithm or formula and showing up as a, what is what I talk about, your scalable genius in the world, especially when you're the product. So it's really designed for creatives and solo professionals.
Yeah.
I'm excited about that. I'm excited to teach. I love teaching. I love helping people see that they don't have to dilute themselves to be successful.
I love all that. And this has really been an interesting chat for me. I really appreciate your honesty and authenticity and just, you know, showing up in the world the way that you do. And to our listeners, I'm going to put all of his information in the show notes. His website is massivechange.co. But I really appreciate you, Justin.
Yeah, thank you. And I appreciate you and the way you show up. You know, you are a rare being. Also, You practice a lot of what I refer to as emotional nudity. And
Mm.
not a lot of dudes do that, especially just Gen Xers. I think you're a little older than me, but still Gen X.
Yep.
You don't see that very often, to show up like you do and show the world who you really are. And then you're kind of a Da Vinci. Like, there's so many things that you've done. And I love that you're sort of, you as you live your life, you share the experiences with the world in ways that make it accessible, and it's very inspiring. Like, I think I told you in our when we first met that you got Mr. Rogers energy. And but that is such a rare thing these days. And so please keep doing that. The world needs that kind of sweetness that you bring to the world right now.
Thank you. I'm very honored by your compliments. Thank you very much.
Well, they're all true.
Thank you. Until next time, I'd love to have you on again, and you just keep doing what you're doing. You're showing up in the world in a really great way.
Thank you. I'd love to do that. I'd love to do that. Thank you so much.
All right, take care.
Thank you for listening to The Creative Spark. To learn more about host G. Brian Benson and all that is going on in his Creative Spark world, as well as this week's amazing guest, please visit the show notes. We love building community, making new friends, and spreading the goodness. So don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and share it with your friends and family. Until next time, as Brian always says, be well, be creative, and always be yourself.